This is the most complicated of all the parables. I've been doing parable series since 1993. And as I've studied and the more I've studied, I've been amazed. When I first started, I thought this is going to be simple. I didn't want to do it. That's a long story, how the Lord got me doing parable series. But anyway, I thought, well, this will be simple enough. I'll just go through it and I'll put... But you know, I've been studying, I've been intensely looking at this since 1993. I studied the parables before, but starting seriously, just about a series. And you know what I found? I'm still learning. I thought those simple parables, there's no bottom to it. You can keep going deeper and deeper, and this is the deepest of all the parables. It's the most complex of all the parables. But what is amazing, the bottom line is so simple. There's only one bottom line. We're going to get to it. But how we get there and the process of getting there enlightens us so much to the bottom line. Now, let me mention to you this parable. The whole parable is designed to help us to be ready for Jesus coming, that great wedding event of Jesus coming back that we find in Revelation 19. In talking about the complexness, we're going to look, there are three sets of three in this parable. I'm sorry, there are four sets of three. And let's look at the first set of three. As we go through the parable, you will hear me say historically, there is a historical application. Then you'll hear me say spiritually, and there is a spiritual application of this. And then there is prophetically, there is a prophetic application to this parable. So that's why I say it's complex. You will have all of these three running together in this parable. When we fully understand what Jesus was saying, you'll have three applications. Then you'll have three calls. Three calls are obvious, and we'll see. And I've got some, historically, we can put the dates on them. With Jesus, one of these was historical, the rest was prophetic. So let's look. The first call is until A.D. 31. I will show you the reason I say that in a few moments. But let's look at the first call in Matthew 22, verse 2. Now, if you have your Bible, you might want to follow along. But Matthew 22 and verse 2 says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son." This was not an ordinary wedding. This was a special one. In 1981, a special wedding was to take place. The social world's eyes were all looking toward England. A future king was about to be married. Now, I see some of you smiling, and you know who that is. Who was that? That was Charles and Diana in 1981. Now, a lot has happened since that a wedding came unraveled and death of Diana and so on. But at that time, there was no higher in the social world, no higher honor than to be asked to be in the presence of that wedding. Only a small number of people compared to the world, only, I don't know exactly how many, but I understand it was less than 1,000, got to be right on sight, right on scene, as far as the guests were concerned. So here we have a king whose marriage of his son was about to take place. Now, something I want to point out to you. This whole parable, I've already alluded to that, this whole parable is to tell us how to be ready for Jesus coming. That's what this whole parable is about. And Jesus goes through this showing historically, spiritually, prophetically how we can do that. And so the first call goes out, notice in verse 3, and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding. And they were not willing to come. Now he invites all of these people to the wedding. He invites his subjects to the wedding. Now historically and biblically as we look, this father represents God the Father in the parable. And who are his subjects in the Old Testament? Israel or the Jews, right? Now, everyone on earth was, but in particular was the Jews. So he's inviting them. Now, by the way, the Jews were to prepare the world for Messiah's coming, right? Do we all agree on that? Okay, so he sends this wedding invitation out, and he says, come to the wedding. That last phrase, though, kind of catches us off guard. They were not willing to come. Now, that's a general statement. And behind all general statements, there is an element that is not fully true there. When you say everyone does this, does that mean everyone or most people? And this, again, was a figure of speech that Jesus was using in the parable. They were not willing to come as a generality that the majority were not willing to come. God has always had a remnant, always had a people from the time that sin came into this world until Jesus comes again. He's always had some people, hasn't he? And so, and this time was no different. But what he's saying, in general, he was rejected. Now, so that first call goes out, especially to the Jews, that special invitation to come and be there, and most of them reject it. Now, there are three callings also. Not only three callings as far as timeline, but three different kinds of calling. First of all, to be the guest. We find that in Matthew 22, 3, 4, and 9. Each time a call goes out to be the guest at the wedding. And then the second call as ambassadors. Now, in 2 Corinthians 5:20 is a reference to that. But he sent his servants. His servants in the Bible, in the Old Testament, it's like the prophets or the priests and different ones. His church leaders, his people were the servants. So he sends them out. Now we're going to see in the last days there's the priesthood of all believers, so we're all to be ambassadors going out and inviting people for the second coming. So a call to be the guest, a call to be the ambassador, and thirdly, the call to be the bride. We find that in Revelation chapter 19, verses 7 through 9, and also Revelation 22, 17. We could look at other texts, there are many more, but that is just a point. There are three distinct callings beside the three calls as far as timeline. Now, the second call is actually from A.D. 31 through A.D. 34. Now, by this time, you might be wondering, where am I getting these dates? Well, we will look at it here in verse 4. Again, he sent out other servants. Now, by the way, this is the second call. Notice it says again. And he sent out other servants, indicating there had been some time going on here. And some of those original servants, either they weren't, you know, they had passed away, timeline, or they were no longer there as servants. But he says, again, he sent out other servants saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle are killed. and all things are ready, come to the wedding. Now notice it says here how that the fatted cattle, the oxen fatted cattle are what? Killed. And all things are ready. Remember what happens first in this Middle East wedding? What happens first? The banquet. So the banquet is about ready to start. And you see, killing the fatted calf is used many times. That's a way of saying let's have a celebration or a party. So the fact they were killed. But now the fatted cattle and oxen and the sheep. Let's look at a spiritual application here. All the sacrifices of the Old Testament, what did they point to? Or who did they point to? They pointed to the Messiah, Jesus Christ. They were an example. In fact, a lot of people try to say in Revelation, we don't find, I've talked to preachers of other churches, and they say they don't like Revelation because they don't find the blood there. They don't find the sign. I said, wait a minute. 27 times Jesus is called the Lamb in the book of Revelation. And that's what John said, behold the Lamb that takes away the sin of the world. And it talks about how the we're washed in His blood. We could go on, but we're not in Revelation. All I'm pointing out is when He says the fatted oxen and fatted calf are killed, spiritually speaking, it is talking about the cross on Calvary. It's talking about in this wedding, what prepares the people for the wedding and what preparation had to happen before the wedding could happen in His coming again. You know, when you look at the book of Hebrews, how that God is a consuming fire in referring to sin. And all had sinned since Adam and Eve, except for Jesus on earth who died for our sins. And so He became a sinner, not that He sinned. He took our sins. And so when we look at this, it's saying that the cross is the pivotal point of this second call. And the cross happened historically, biblically, in AD 31. That's why the first call goes from the time sin entered the world until the cross. The second call starts at the cross and goes on until AD 34. But this second call is also rejected. But they made light of it, went their ways, one to his own farm, another to his business. And so when we look at this, what about this rejection? Again, it's a general statement. It's not everyone. But talking about how they went their own ways to their farm and the business. It's so easy for us to point fingers back at them and say they should have recognized the Messiah when He's here. They all believed the Messiah was coming. All the Jews believed the Messiah was coming. Why didn't they accept Him? Here it says they were busy. They went their own ways, their own farm, their business, etc. Let's bring it up to our time right now. What about us? Are you ready for Jesus to come again? If you ask most people, are they ready for Jesus to come, who say they believe in the Christian world, including Adventists, are you ready for Jesus? I need to get ready. I said, wait a minute. What's holding you back? What is it that keeps you from being ready for Jesus to come? And bottom line, we're too busy doing our own business with our farms, our businesses, our all of our activities, our jobs, our children, our houses, our whatever. A little bit like we talked about this morning, the cares of this world. And so it's easy to point fingers back at them, but remember when you're pointing back at them, you got three pointing at yourself. The fact is, we are so busy today, we don't have time to get ready to meet our God in Jesus coming again. And Jesus is getting at the heart of this when he says they went their own ways, one to his farm, another to his business. And in other words, they were too stretched out in time to take time to study and pray like we talked about this morning, to share our faith and be ready for his coming. Notice in verse 6, though, and the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. Now let's look historically, although for us, but for Jesus, it was prophetically for the future, because this had not yet happened when he gave this parable. So it was prophecy to Jesus. To us, we look back historically and see what happened. Of the 11 that stayed faithful to Jesus of the 12 disciples, how many of them died a martyr's death? 10? And I heard 11? By the way, both 10 and 11 are right. And you say, how could that be? 10 and 11? That doesn't match up. Well, 10 of them were martyred by cutting off their heads, crucifixion, etc. 10 of them, right then, right there, you know, at a time factor, they died as martyrs for the faith. But John, they threw him, their way of execution for John, they threw him in a big pot of boiling oil. They were going to French fry him. But what was amazing, and it was kind of like it was with the Hebrew children in that fiery furnace, the fire couldn't kill them. Well, neither could this boiling oil. You see, God was not finished with John yet. He hadn't written the book of Revelation yet. So he was exiled on that pile of rocks out there in the Mediterranean, the Alcatraz of that day, and the Isle of Patmos, so that he could not contaminate the world anymore with the gospel, was the way the Romans looked at it. But you see, it teaches us a lesson. And that's why I say all 11 died a martyr's death. John didn't die right there, but he died in exile. They tried to kill him. When they couldn't kill him, they put him in exile. But in that sense, all 11 died a martyr's death. You understand why I said both 10 and 11 are correct now? When you stop to think of it, John was used by God. All of those 11 were used by God. But John had one more thing to do before he was to die, and God wouldn't let the devil himself kill him. And it points a lesson to all of us. If we are in the will of God, nothing on earth can kill us and prevent us from doing what God wants us to do. If God's not finished with you, the devil himself cannot kill you. And if God's finished with us, we don't need to be around him and worry about it. So why worry? Just stay in the will of God and don't worry about if you're going to die or not die or this or that, just stay in the will of God. That's the whole point. John did, and John, even the boiling oil, couldn't kill him. Well, let's go on. In verse 7. But when the king heard about it, he was furious and sent out his armies, destroyed those murders, and burned their city. Now, when we look at this, in the day that Jesus was telling is in this parable was totally different than today. In that day, if that had happened to a literal king, there would be no inquiry, there would be no investigation, there would be no waiting period. He would have sent his armies out there and slaughtered them on the spot. That's just the way it was back then. But you see, God is more merciful than that. God gives time for repentance. So it wasn't until A.D. 70, about 40 years later, that God destroyed Jerusalem and burned that city and destroyed all of those who were in it. But now let's qualify that. All the Jews in Jerusalem were killed except a few that were taken captive. And the biggest exception was the Jews who believed in their Messiah, their Jewish Messiah, Jesus. You see, they followed what Matthew chapter 24, Jesus warned, talking about when they came. That's part of the prophecy. Sometimes we think if it's only the second coming, but you remember there were three questions asked at the beginning of Matthew 24. And one of those, when are we going to see when are these things happening? The destruction of the temple. Remember that was in verse 2 and 3 there. Or verse 2 and verse 3, they asked the question. And so he told them there how to avoid being killed at the destruction of the, Jerusalem and the temple. And the Christians followed. So none of the Jews who were believers in Jesus died. So all the Jews, all the unbelieving Jews were either killed or taken captive. And all the believing Jews, not one of them died. But it happened in A.D. 70. Jesus prophetically said, that's what's going to happen in this parable. It did happen. Historically, we look back at it and say A.D. 70 is when Jerusalem was destroyed and all those people were destroyed. So when that city was burned and destroyed, it stayed for many years annihilated there. In Matthew 22, verse 8, then he said to his servants, the wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Now let's stop here just for a moment. I almost skipped something. On Friday, we will cover some of the basis of it. You know, this prophecy, when I mentioned A.D. 34, I didn't go into that at all. And I should at least touch base here. Why I said A.D. 31, we got that because of the cross. If we look at Daniel chapter 9, and we're going to do that on Friday. That's one reason I don't want to go into much of that now. But if we look at Daniel chapter 9, it was at the end of the 70 weeks. Now the gospel was to go to the Gentiles, wasn't it? So that starts the third call. You see, that second call was A.D. 31 to A.D. 34. That last call, or the third call, goes from A.D. 34 until he comes again. So if we look at the timelines, that first call was up until A.D. 31. The second call was A.D. 31 to A.D. 34. The third call is A.D. 34 till Jesus comes again. So I'm not going to say more about Matthew 9. Daniel 9, we will deal with that on Friday morning. So now notice in verse 8, he said, the wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. They didn't respond to the invitation. What is amazing to me, both in Charles and Diana's wedding, and by the way, most recently, we have another future king that got married, right? William and Kate. I never heard of one person, of course I don't know everything, but that denied, saying, no, I'm not going to go. When they had a written invitation to go to that wedding, that was the highest social honor that you could have on the face of the earth at that time. And so to be the guest at the wedding of the universe and the king of the universe, there is no higher honor than to be at that wedding. But we will also look at the bride and also the ambassador. But let's look at the third call. Starting AD 34, goes on to Christ's return. We've just touched on that. Therefore, go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding. Now, this is different. This is why we can say it was going to the Gentiles and everyone. They were to go to the highways and byways everywhere and invite them to the wedding. It was no longer exclusive to, quote, God's people or those there. Now it's open to everyone. By the way, salvation has been open to everyone all down through time since sin came. But there was a deliverance of the message by God's people. Now, we have a lesson to learn as Seventh-day Adventists. The Jews did not prepare the world for Jesus' first coming in general. Yes, some did, and it's a general statement. But according to Revelation, the Christians will be no more ready for Jesus' second coming than the Jews were for the first coming. Is that right in Revelation? So let's not be pointing the finger back there. We're in this generation. Are we really preparing the people for Jesus' second coming? I almost feel another sermon coming on, so we better finish this one. Let's go on. Now they are to go in the highways and byways and invite everyone to the wedding. Now who are the ambassadors? It wasn't just the chosen priests and prophets that were in the first two. Now we have the priesthood of all believers. The priest was to give in symbol how salvation was coming. But when Jesus came on the cross, now all believers are with the gospel commission and go and share the way of salvation with every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. So now we're the ambassadors. We show that is those three callings. You remember a calling to be the guest. Now here's a calling to be the ambassador. Now you are to go out and share with people. Come to the Lord's wedding. Jesus is coming again. Prepare to meet your God. The highways, as many as you find, invite to the wedding. So we're to be that special guest. We're also to be the ambassador, going out and inviting others. By the way, what an honor to be the ambassador. You know, back in the States, if the president called you and asked you to be the ambassador to another country, would that be an honor? Now, I don't know here in Canada who it is that chooses the ambassadors of the various countries, but whoever it is, if that person were to call you and say, we want you to be ambassador from Canada to someone, would that be an honor? But the King of the universe has asked us to be his ambassador to His people that are not ready for Jesus coming. What an honor. We're to be the honored guest, the honored ambassador. Let's go a little further now. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. I remember the first time I read this. It tells a little bit about in the program my background. I accepted the Lord behind a steering wheel of a truck. Now, I've never read much before that. Wasn't interested in reading and all those kinds of things. But once I received Jesus, in the first 6 months, I read the Bible through twice. I heard what people had said it meant and what the Bible was about, but I had not really looked in to find for myself. I read it through twice. And I remember the first time I came across this verse. And even in my young Christian life, I realized this parable was about Jesus coming again. And I looked and it says He found both bad and good. And I thought, are there going to be bad people in heaven? That really bothered me. Bad people in heaven? Why would they be inviting the bad people? And it wasn't until I understood later the Pharisaical mindset that permeated that time and culture of where the Pharisees and what they taught were the good people. In reality, how many of us are bad? All have sinned and come short of the glory of God, right? But God is in the business of making bad people good. And what He was saying here, and by the way, when I learned a little Greek and I realized that the bad is listed before the good, that meant there were more bad people there than good people. That really bothered me, but then I realized that in the Greek, it's emphasizing who are the most, and what Jesus was saying to the Pharisees in that Pharisaical world, there are going to be more of what the Pharisees considered bad than what the Pharisees considered good in the kingdom. And by the way, maybe if we look at it that way, the Pharisees theologically were more correct than any of the other parts of the Jew. You know, the Sadducees and the Essenes, the Herodians, the Zealots, and on with the various groups. Kind of like our denominations today. We all claim to be Christian, but you know, we all have different beliefs. The Pharisees theologically were more correct than the other ones. That's why if we bring it fast forward to our day, we are the Pharisees of 2013. More theologically correct, right? Now, I didn't see any of you liking that. I just tell it like it is. Because the more truth we have, the more Pharisaical we act many times. And you understand what I'm saying, Pharisaical. That's why Jesus had some strong words for them. He said, do as they say, but not as they do. In other words, theologically they're correct, but their application of theology is not good. Weddings are a special time. All brides are beautiful. But we, all the saved, are the bride as well. So we play three roles. We're the guest. How can you be a guest and the bride at the same time? Well, let's go step by step. First of all, a guest, we're invited. Secondly, we're an ambassador. By the way, the bride, who does the wedding invitations? The bride does, right? So that's why we are both a guest and ambassador. and thirdly, the bride. And we're going to come back to that in a few moments. The wedding garment is the righteousness of Christ. Let's look at verse 11 now. But when the king came in to see the guest, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. And he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment?" And he was speechless. Again, going back to me reading this through the first time as a new convert, as a new Christian, I grew up in a poor family. And I felt sorry for this man. I thought maybe he was too poor to buy a suit or a tuxedo to go to the wedding. But it wasn't until I studied later and in school I found out. I also received the call to ministry behind the steering wheel of a truck. And so now I'm going to school and I learn. The custom of that day, if a king invited you to his son or daughter's wedding, he provided the wedding garment. So when it says he was speechless, after all, if he was too poor to buy it, he could have said to king, "Look, I'm sorry, I just didn't have the money to buy this tuxedo." He was speechless because the king had given him the garment. But he had refused to put on the garment. Or at least keep it on. Now, by the way, this whole story, and I wish I had enough time to develop this part. This part of between the banquet and then the later part of the wedding is what we call as Adventists the investigative judgment. What the king was doing right here was that. All of those who wanted to be part of the wedding were all gathered at the banquet, but now the king is going around and inspecting them if they were ready to go to the rest of the wedding or not. The pre-Advent judgment or investigative judgment, it is in the Bible all through it. I don't have the time to develop it, but it's shown clearly here. Now, it uses one man as an example of, or to signify, or to symbolize all of those who were not going to be at the final coming. You see, the bridegroom was not there yet. The banquet starts without the bridegroom being there. Well, you remember the parable of the 10 virgins? Yeah, the banquet was going on and then the bridegroom comes. Remember that? That was the custom. So the coming of Jesus had not yet happened in the spiritual application here, but the Father was going over and checking out all of those who were at the banquet. This man did not have on a wedding garment. And what happens to him? That wedding garment is the righteousness of Christ. That's the garment. You can look at, Christ's Object Lesson, page 320, I believe it is, and it tells you flat out that's what it is. Going on to verse 13. Then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot. Take him away and cast him into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Now that weeping and gnashing of teeth and all the parables of Jesus refer to those who are ultimately lost and those who end up in hellfire. You see, this man wanted to be at the wedding, but he wanted to be there on his own ground, his own basis, his own righteousness. He was thrown out. The investigation judgment goes over the book of life. And those who have the righteousness of Christ will stay. Those who don't, cast out. That is in the preparing for Jesus' coming. That's what he was referring to here in this part of the parable. Do you understand? Do you see how this parable is so deep and a lot more complex? And yet, it all fits together when we go down through, and it all fits in a way that we can understand it. But now let's go back. We mentioned the robe of Christ's righteousness is the wedding garment. We all agreed on that? Okay. Now, if all of the others at that banquet, which is the beginning, the precursor to the wedding, what did the man who didn't have the wedding garment have on? Oh, his own righteousness. But our righteousness, according to Isaiah 64:6, is like what? Filthy rags. Oh, do you understand why he was thrown out? Could you imagine someone coming to Charles and Diana's wedding in filthy rags? Do you think they would let him get within a mile or 2 miles of that wedding if that's what he came in? Probably the same with William and Kate, right? But let's look for just a moment. Filthy rags at a wedding? Any wedding, that would be totally inappropriate, wouldn't it? That's what you want to wear at home or somewhere else, that's one thing. But at a wedding, it's totally inappropriate. Any wedding. Secondly, how inappropriate it would be to wear the filthy rags to the wedding of a king. And just like I said, they're not going to get within a mile or two of those two royal weddings that we just referred to of Charles and also of William's later. Thirdly, filthy rags to the wedding of the King of the Universe? Wow. That's not going to happen. And then ultimately, the most inappropriate thing that could ever be done in the universe is filthy rags to the wedding of the King of the Universe and be the bride. For those who are trying to work their way to heaven. And in the book, Great Controversy, it points out, behind all false religion is salvation by works. All false religion on the face of this earth, it's salvation by works. This gets at the heart of it. You know, we have all kinds of books and all kinds of charts and all kinds of ideas that people have put out. This is what you have to do to get ready for Jesus coming. Jesus makes it simple. It says one thing. One. And it all has to do with the wedding garment. The wedding garment is the focal part. You see, in this parable, Jesus is saying, I want you to have an eternal spiritual, I want you to be my eternal spiritual bride and invite everyone to the wedding. See, that shows that we are to be, and that's how we are, the guest and the bride. I'm the guest to you being married to Jesus. And you're the guest to me being married to Jesus. But we're both guest and bride and ambassadors inviting them to the wedding. What do we do with the righteousness of Christ? That's the bottom line of being ready for His coming. That's why this last verse in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 14. For many are called, but few are chosen. What's the difference between the called and chosen? You remember this third call, go out, invite everyone. Go the highways, go invite everyone to come. Everyone's invited. But all did not choose to receive that invitation. And in the context of the wedding garment, which is just in the verses above it, the chosen, it's what they have done with the wedding garment that makes them the chosen and not just called. You see, the man in that wedding feast that did not have the wedding garment on, he was called, but he wasn't chosen. He was called, he was there at the banquet hall, but he was not chosen because he had not chosen to put on the wedding garment. There are three things we need to, I've mentioned there are four sets of three. Here's the last set of three, the fourth one. And this parable, this last set, and this is something that I've done, and as I studied it, I applied it, is not intrinsically in there, but it is in a different way. What is necessary for the chosen to do with the wedding garment? First of all, they must accept it. This goes in the Bible principle, how we accept we're sinners, saved by grace. I know I'm a sinner, therefore I need the righteous and want the righteousness of Christ. So that's the first, that I accept that I can't be saved of myself. There's no way I can save myself. So I accept His righteousness. My righteousness will never make it. Never prepare me for His coming. I don't care how much I do, and I could even be a martyr, but if I don't have the righteousness of Jesus, I'm not going to be there. Secondly, not only to accept it. Now, in my mind, I could just see this man that didn't have the robe on at the door as he came in. They gave him the robe and he lays it across his arm. And he goes in and he says, I like my clothes better than that. And sets it off somewhere as he goes sit on the seat. You see, he accepted the fact that he wanted to be ready for Jesus coming. But he wanted to be ready for Jesus coming on his ground, on his righteousness. He wanted to be good enough to be there. But we must put on the robe. Not only accept the fact that I need Jesus and that I'm not as righteous as I should be, but that I need to put it on and saying the only way I can be saved is to put it on. His righteousness, not mine. His works, not mine. And thirdly, we must keep it on. We don't know. Another scenario might have been he went in, got it, went in the changing room, put it on, looked in the mirror and thought, you know, I like my clothes better, and take it back off and put it, and then go on in. I don't know, but that very well could have happened. That's the way some of us are. We put it on, but then we go back to try to be good enough and to build our own righteousness. And like the Apostle Paul talks about many of the Jews that didn't understand by faith and went out to do their own righteousness, not realizing Christ's righteousness. Now that doesn't mean we can't do good things. Just keep it on. I know some people, and when I've talked this way, they say, well, wait a minute, don't you know we're supposed to keep the Sabbath and we're supposed to do all these things? That's what the Bible says, we are to do these things. But why do we do them? John 14:15, Jesus said, if you, what? Love me, do what? Keep my commands. Oh, so I don't do them to be saved. I do them because I love Jesus. There's an entirely different motivation for me keeping the Sabbath or any of the other commandments. But when I am trying to earn my salvation and be ready for Jesus coming by keeping the Sabbath, I got the whole wrong thing. I'm putting off that robe and leaving on my own robe of self-righteousness. So the three things. What are they again? Accepting the robe. Then next what? Put it on. And what's the third one? Keep it on. Now this keeping on. Now some of us think about salvation and Christ's righteousness. Say, oh, that's good. That's what he does for me. But what about living day to day? How does it affect me? Grace not only washes away my sin. Grace empowers me to overcome my sins. You see, by keeping Christ's robe of righteousness on, not only does it cover my sins, not only does it cover my sins, it washes them away. Not only does it wash our sins away, it empowers us not to continue in sin. So his robe is not to just cover up and not just to wash away, but is to do those two plus give us the victory over. To become truly Christ-like. To become truly a Christian Christ-like. So, you know, that's pretty simple, isn't it? Now, we took a long way to get there in the complex, and it just shows how that, yes, historically, spiritually, and prophetically, this parable shows us how to get ready for Jesus coming again. Now, the question is, what will we do with Christ's righteousness? Because the whole parable, the bottom line, is all about the wedding garment, isn't it? Will we accept it, put it on, and keep it on? That's the whole question. What will we do with the righteousness of Christ? And what we do with the righteousness of Christ will be whether we are his bride for eternity or we're in the fire, cast out from God. It's that simple. Is that simple or what? I told you it's the most complex parable, but it ended up bottom line being the simplest. So I'm not going to have to worry about all kind of charts and graphs. I'm not going to have to worry if I'm going to be strong enough to be a martyr or not. I'm not going to have to worry about how am I going to stand in the time of the mark of the beast. I need to be concerned about one thing. The righteousness of Christ. Will I keep on that wedding garment or will I not? And that is the issue. So many times we put it on and say, yeah, that's what I need. Next day, we got it off and we're trying to do it ourselves. Been there, done that? You see, that's why I said these last three steps, that putting on, even more important than putting on, once it's on, that we keep it on. And that's what prepares us for his coming. And as long as we keep the wedding garment on, we don't have to be worry about all of these other things. That's God's business. Let him take care of that. I just need to stay in his hands. I need to stay in his robe of righteousness. Now I ask the question, what are you going to do this morning? I should say this afternoon, with the robe. Most of us, the reason you're at camp meeting, you've accepted it, and you've at least temporarily put it on. But where we are at camp meeting, now when I talk these parables where that is not the case, I go through all three steps more deliberately. But are you going to keep it on? Do you understand keeping it on is what prepares you for his coming? Is that your desire this morning or this afternoon? If it is, would you just lift your hand up toward Jesus now, wherever you are? He wants us to be His bride for eternity in that special relationship. It's all about His coming again. And as our testimony, I'd like for us to stand and sing together, "I Surrender All." Because that surrendering of myself is what allows me to keep on His righteousness. So let's stand as we sing this, as we close this morning, this afternoon.